The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. So the first question is, were you able to hear the bell? I've been having some trouble sometimes with the bell not transmitting on over the electronic connection. So if you didn't hear it, the bell did ring, and please let me know in the chat so that I will know what to do tomorrow. And in the meantime, we'll go ahead with the talk. So this week is called Flavors of the Dharma, as I mentioned. Novel, okay, thank you. We'll fix that tomorrow. This week is called Flavors of the Dharma. And I mentioned just briefly before the sitting, but in case you weren't here, we'll be exploring how certain teachings have a distinct emotional tone or flavor that is meant to support practice. And the reason I've chosen this particular lens or way of seeing it is that there is a precedent for it from the aesthetic culture of ancient India. The Buddha was teaching in a cultural context that included a highly developed aesthetic sense. So he was in this environment. And of course, spiritual teachings are distinct from art like poetry. But still, there was this context surrounding the presentation of spiritual teachings, if you will, which also have an emotional tone, of course. And there was a word for this. It's called rasa. R-A-S-A, which means nectar or essence or taste. And it's the emotional experience that's evoked in the listener. And there was a standard set of rasas that were evoked in art. This was kind of understood. And people in the sort of high up in Indian society would have known about these rasas. And we see them, some of them reflected in the suttas. So today we have the rasa of love or compassion, or more generally care. And all of these in a spiritual sense, of course. In the regular arts, they would include romantic love or other things like that. But within the suttas, we do see a flavor of care in a spiritual sense, in a way that would support our practice, our path toward liberation. And so, with each of these flavors, we'll look at suttas that are examples of it, and we'll consider when and how that flavor is useful in our practice. So I hope that will be of interest this week. So this flavor of love or care, it really underlies and supports Dharma practice at a base level. There's a sutta about the king of Kosala, whose name was King Pasenadi. And he was a follower of the Buddha, a devoted follower, but not a great meditator, very sincere nonetheless. And in this teaching, he is talking to his queen, whose name was Queen Malika. And he says to her, "My dear queen, is there anyone more dear to you than yourself?" And apparently he was hoping that she would say, "Why, yes, you are more dear to me than myself." But that's not what she says. Actually, what she says is, "There's no one, great king, more dear to me than myself." Kind of straightforward. And then she asks him the same thing and says, well, king, is there anyone more dear to you than yourself?" And given how the conversation has gone up to that point, he has to reply in kind, "Well, no, actually, there is no one more dear to me than myself." And he's a little taken by this conversation. And so he goes to the Buddha and he says everything that happened in that conversation. And the Buddha uses it as an opportunity to offer an ethical message of care. You know, so the Buddha approves of what the queen said. And he says, having traversed all quarters with the mind, one finds none anywhere dearer than oneself. Likewise, each person holds himself most dear or herself most dear. Hence, one who loves herself should not harm others. So we see that this sense of, you know, being dear to ourself is actually in this sutta pointed to as the basis for caring for others. So at a base level, we are generally dear to ourselves. We care about ourselves in some way, and this is normal and is in fact the basis for wholesome conduct. So the Buddha is praising this, the queen's assertion of self-love. In another sutta with this same King Pasenadi, the king notes that people who engage in unwholesome actions treat themselves as a foe, even if they say they are holding themselves dear. And also, people who engage in wholesome actions treat themselves as dear, even if they say they regard themselves as a foe. And the Buddha again agrees with him. So it, our actions, you know, if we are behaving poorly out in the world, we're lying or we're manipulating people or we're being unkind in some way, even if we say we're doing it because we care about ourselves, we're standing up for ourselves, we're, if I don't take care of myself, who will? We're treating ourselves as a foe because we're engaging in these harmful actions that actually have an impact on us, even if we think we're helping ourselves. And people who attempt to live ethically, who try to be kind, who don't lie or steal or manipulate, sometimes people like that will say that they're unhappy with themselves and you know, that they don't love themselves so much. But these very actions of trying to care, wanting to care, are good for us. They help us at some level. So we could get in better alignment, actually, by also loving ourselves, also being kind to ourselves. So we see that the Buddha is quite clear that ethics and positive self-regard overlap. Ethical conduct is the basis of the Eightfold Path, and so is care for ourselves and others. There's another sutta that says this in a nice way. There's a story of a newly ordained monk who keeps having difficulty following the monastic rules because there's so many of them, right? But the other monks, so he's always kind of making mistakes and looking awkward. And the other monks are, you know, he didn't do that right. But they sense that he is proceeding from deep love and faith in the Buddha. You know, he's ordained out of really deep faith. And so, you know, when they think about it, they decide not to discipline him very much because it might dampen his faith and love. And they don't, that would be more harmful for him. So they're kind to him. And eventually he grows into being able to manage the monastic life and live up to all the rules that there are. So we have this sense again that deep love and faith as a basis for practice really help things to unfold well. If we look across the suttas, it's probably the case that the Buddha rarely displayed what we would conventionally consider to be love here in the West. Many of his teachings were a little analytical or a little tough sometimes to wake people up a little bit. But many of his teachings, you know, really were profoundly caring. He met people right where they were, using language that they could understand. That in and of itself is an act of care and love and compassion. You know, for example, there's a story of, I think many of you know the story of Kisa Gotami, who was a woman who whose child had died. And, you know, she wasn't really a practitioner at that time, but and she was so distraught that her son had died that she was actually carrying him around while he was dead and trying to get somebody to help her. And people were turning away. And she finally found the Buddha a little bit when she was a little bit crazed. And he said to her, okay, I can help you. And so she's, oh, thank goodness. And he says, go to a house, find a mustard seed from some household where no one has died, and bring me that mustard seed. And so she sets off to do this task, right? And, you know, mustard seed is hardly worth anything. Everybody would be willing to give her one. But she goes from house to house, and of course, there isn't any household where no one has died. So she learns in that way that her situation, although difficult, is just real. It's normal. That's how it is. And that was so much more profound of a way of learning it than anything else, you know, that could have been offered, anything that could have been told to her or explained to her or anything like that. So this is a way where the Buddha was being profoundly caring, although, you know, somewhat strong, tough. And she comes back and understands and is willing to bury her son, and she becomes a nun and becomes awakened, as these stories go. So there are many, many examples of love and compassion and care in the Buddhist teachings. It's threaded all throughout, and it also comes forth explicitly in some of the cases, like the ones that we've explored today. So, you know, when is it appropriate to use this flavor or savor, maybe we could say rasa is sometimes called savor, also savor of love or compassion or care. I mean, there are so many, right? But we could just name a few, which is, you know, we need to give ourselves time. So we need to just do the practice without seeking results or achievements. You know, it can sometimes seem a little distant, you know, why am I sitting here trying to be with the breath? I really need to think about this problem that I have. I have to work on this relationship. That's what keeps coming to mind. But if we just stay with the breath, stay with the body, stay with the mindfulness practice that we're doing, it has a way of affecting us more profoundly than we realize. You know, like going to house from house to house, asking about a mustard seed. That was so much more effective than, say, grief counseling, if you will, you know, when that instruction was given by the Buddha and she was willing to do it. So, you know, there's this doing of the practice, just to give ourselves time to unfold, to let it do its work. That is profoundly loving. And of course, at moments when there's a lot of dukkha, we can bring self-compassion directly to our situation. Sometimes that might look like self-care in some way, or maybe just seeing clearly that what is happening is the most loving thing that we can do. We may not need to bring in ideas about our story and other things, but just see directly and feel how it is. Yeah, it's really hard right now without a story. It's just, this is it. Deeply compassionate. And also, you know, love and care is the indirect basis for so much of cushion practice. There are so many cases where in kind of in a standard sequence of sitting down to get ready to meditate, some of the suttas will say that the practitioner sits down, has an upright posture, establishes compassion for all beings, and then brings mindfulness to the fore and begins to meditate. So we can do this also, is have a sense that we're meditating out of compassion for ourselves and all others. So I really see this as a foundation for so much of what we do. It helps so much unfold when we have a basis of love or care. And I'm careful to use those general words so that we can find our own way of meeting that. Today in the United States, it's a holiday. It's Juneteenth. which celebrates or commemorates the emancipation of African American slaves in 1865. And so maybe it's appropriate that we talk today about ethics and love and compassion and care as a basis for ourselves, our life, our relationships, and indeed our whole society. So tomorrow we'll be on to a different flavor, a different rasa, 5 of them this week. And I hope you'll enjoy this tour of some of the emotional tones that we see in the Buddha's teachings. So be well.